Hi, it's Jeremy Liu. Thanks for joining us on our Lightspeed podcast. I'm joined today by Taylor Lorenz.
Hello.
Taylor is my favorite writer on the topics of popular culture and consumer tech and the intersection of those two things and how they collide.
Thank you. It's high praise.
She covers this topic at The Atlantic today, but has spent a bunch of time in a bunch of other terrific publications.
Yeah, I have written about internet culture for a while. I was at The Daily Beast previous to The Atlantic and freelanced for a lot of other places. I wrote for New York Mag, Fast Company, BuzzFeed, Mike.com. It's been a journey.
And you've been covering this intersection for such a long time and with the perspective of not just an outside observer, but a participant. We've seen generations of new kind of social media apps, whether it be Vine, Tumblr before that, Instagram, Snap, now Musical.ly, now TikTok. They all seem to start with a particular audience. It tends to skew young, it tends to skew female. Why do you think that is?
I think young women are notorious early adopters of stuff, like, you know, especially social platforms and stuff. Older users usually don't use it as much. And also, I think, I don't know, young women, it seems like, are really more comfortable, I guess, expressing themselves online and connecting online. Like, obviously, young women are very social people for the most part, I would say. So I would assume that's why they kind of gravitate first towards social apps. I guess that's been the trend with pretty much everything. You just mentioned TikTok, which formerly as Musical.ly was hugely skewed young and female. A lot of like famous musers are all kind of young women, very, very young. I guess it's sort of just like natural tendencies. Definitely, I know like when I was a young woman, I was really into like, you know, making friends, seeing what's up, kind of keeping on top of trends. Maybe young guys just aren't as expressive on those platforms.
Do you think that's changing at all? Do you think the Generation Z, the men of Generation Z are adopting them a little bit more?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think that young men are getting more comfortable expressing themselves online and like creating content. I mean, that's just a trend, I think, with all of sort of like Gen Z, I guess. I'm writing this thing on like SoundCloud, like hip hop producers. So I don't know if that's just in my mind, but like a lot of like young kind of like urban kids, especially are like hyper online, like hyper involved, like on, you know, Twitter or SoundCloud or whatever. You know, I wouldn't say it's just young women, but I do think that young women especially are just sort of like more expressive on these platforms. I don't know necessarily why that is, except that I think like for social reasons, probably, like, you know, men just sort of have been socialized, I think, to express themselves less, which is hopefully changing and seems to be changing a little bit.
It's a bit of a stereotype, but I think there's some truth to it that, you know, women form relationships by talking to each other. And whether that's happening face-to-face or over social media, these are conversations that are happening, and that's building relationships. Yeah. Whereas men form relationships by doing things at the same time in parallel,
yeah,
you know, to avoid having to talk to each other. And that might be playing Fortnite or it might be, you know, playing basketball, but it really is almost a different vector for how those relationships get formed. But you mentioned something else that was interesting, which is your African-American youth is, as a group, also an early adopter of popular culture, whether it be consumer tech popular culture or music or dance. I mean, I think broadly speaking, and it's not just on SoundCloud and TikTok, but Black Vine was a thing. Twitter was a thing really early.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see whether or not that starts to get reflected in the entrepreneur base.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Like, I mean, yeah, people need to fund more. Definitely, like, there needs to be more diversity in terms of, like, you know, I guess, products that get funded, it seems like. I know that there's always, I've not really written that much about, like, tech diversity stuff, but I have read a lot of, like, kind of sad numbers around that, just saying that, like, Black entrepreneurs aren't getting funded, like, products, and there's not obviously not a ton of you know, people of color working in engineering roles or product roles. So hopefully that's going to change because there's probably missing out on a lot of really amazing ideas and products.
Well, that is the thing with consumer technology today. The unique insight to popular culture is actually more valuable than the ability to go build an app or build a website or build an e-commerce, you know, site today. And so we've certainly seen that shift start to happen slowly with respect to female entrepreneurs. And hopefully it's just a matter of time before we see the same shift happening with you know, entrepreneurs of color.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things that I think has been really interesting has been watching how the rise of influencers on all of these social media platforms has been really notable and significant. And in many instances, the influencers that arose on a new platform stay on that platform. But in many instances, they actually move to bigger platforms and bring their audiences with them.
Yeah. So I feel like in the influencer community, I mean, as soon as you get popular on one platform, you want to diversify and level up in a sense. I think a few years ago, people were maybe more complacent where they were like, oh, you know, I'm a Vine star, I'm going to stay on Vine. But actually, sort of as Vine began to decline, a lot of, you know, influencers left. And I think as people realize how transient like fame can be on these platforms, I mean, a lot of these platforms can change their algorithm or roll out a new feature and you just don't have the audience that you used to. So I think if you are, you know, a savvy influencer, you know to diversify your audience as much as possible. And obviously you want to scale up too. Like if you get big on some obscure app, like you want to port that audience onto, you know, like YouTube, Instagram, places where you can monetize more effectively. A lot of people, I mean, a lot of influencers when they're starting out will do deals with like startups, like maybe some startup live streaming app is going to pay content creators to produce content on there. And so they'll do that, one, for money, also to get somewhat of an audience and then tell, you know, like port that audience basically onto like Instagram or somewhere where they can start really monetizing by selling like pre-roll ad units, all that kind of stuff. I would say the main places to monetize are obviously YouTube and also Instagram seem to be like the big platforms. So yeah, it makes sense. I think it's so precarious when you're an influencer and you're relying on, you know, the sort of like the main thing that you're offering is this audience and the ability to reach this audience. And if one of these platforms that your audience lives on changes something that sort of inhibits that ability, it can jeopardize, you know, your career and income. So it's good to just not have all your, what's the expression? Like, don't have all your eggs in one basket or something like that.
Do you think it's that they are seeking bigger audiences, or do you think it's that they are seeking more diversification, or do you think it's they're seeking the places where they can get paid the most, or are they all related?
I think it's all related, and it's a little bit of all three. I mean, a lot of them are not necessarily like diversifying their audience. It's probably the same core group of fans that are going to follow this person on every sort of platform. I think it's like protecting themselves from like product changes within these platforms that they're not like completely reliant on one versus the other. And then that also allows you to diversify your revenue stream. So yeah, you might be selling, you know, ads on YouTube, but maybe you're also doing sponsored content on Instagram. These are all ways you can make money. And so that's also another good thing where it's like, it's not like all your money is coming from one platform again, because they can make a change and then you're kind of out of luck. A lot of influencers are all about scale, so they do just want to get as big as possible, which makes sense. And then some others have a really unique, you know, maybe they're never going to get huge, but they have some kind of like unique niche that they're in that's valuable to brands in that space, and they want to be on like platforms that are relevant to that. I don't know. Like if you're a lifestyle influencer, obviously you're going to be on Instagram, probably Pinterest too, maybe some other kind of like fashion startup type apps or things. But the most important thing is that advertisers can come to you and that you have like a broad reach and that you can like work with them in some capacity. So.
And so to what extent do you think the influencers are trying to control their own destiny by having direct deals through which they monetize relative to being able to rely on the platforms?
Yeah. Most of these platforms don't build in ways for creators to monetize. Platforms will build in ad units for brands to buy or sponsors, sometimes like sponsored units that, you know, you can buy through the platform. But platforms don't usually like provide some kind of creator portal. YouTube is probably the best in that sense. They've always really catered to the creator community and allowed, you know, creators to like, you know, run ads on their channels and sort of like take a cut of that and stuff. And, you know, there's obviously networks and people can work directly and so, you know, I would say YouTube has the best tools for creators. Instagram really doesn't provide any kind of oversight or creator specific portals or, you know, ways for them to monetize. So Instagrammers are still, people with huge Instagram audiences do monetize, but they are working with directly, you know, with brands on that kind of negotiation. And Instagram did offer like the ability to denote when you've done a paid partnership. They've done some things, but they just haven't, like there's no standardized kind of process for people to find creators. And Instagram doesn't, you know, itself have a creator network or anything like that. I guess the same is for TikTok also. It sort of like doesn't have any kind of internal like creator system, but they seem to cater to creators. It's not to say that these platforms don't want creators on there. They definitely do. But I think it's just kind of a big nebulous area. And a lot of them are thinking more about like getting ads on the platform directly. So
if you think about all the various platforms, typically they all have this life cycle where like they grow to a certain scale and, you know, they age up as that happens. But one of the things that's been interesting about YouTube is there was a recent Piper Jaffray survey which showed that now YouTube was actually increasing popularity amongst Gen Z, the youngest audience. And I wonder if that is related to the fact that the influencers have a better opportunity to make money through that platform without having to go out and do everything on their own.
YouTube is definitely like the gold standard for creators. Like everyone wants to be a YouTuber. I think it's seen as like culturally like maybe superior in certain ways to other platforms, maybe because you like, along with being a successful YouTuber, it's sort of like understood that you like you're more legit or something, as opposed to like getting famous on a bunch of apps and kind of hopping around. It is interesting to see the way that they work creators. I mean, creators also get very frustrated with YouTube. You know, it's such a huge platform and they can never, you know, make everyone happy. I know around this time last year, they put some kind of caps in place where they were going to no longer pay out, you know, to creators who don't upload a certain amount of hours of content and stuff. And it made a lot of like illustrators on YouTube mad. And so it's very hard and dicey, but they do have a huge creator team and network and they work really hard. You know, they're just putting together YouTube Rewind right now, which is this huge video that they do every year to feature creators. And, you know, Instagram, other platforms haven't really done that. Like why a lot of Vine stars initially left to go to YouTube is because Vine was not really, you know, providing them any easy way to monetize. And these people have to make money.
Right. YouTube, while they've had more of a focus on monetization, they also have far greater engagement as a platform for the creators, right? I mean, people spend more time, they watch more of the videos.
Yeah, yeah. And also people are watching longer videos. I think as they're, you know, as YouTube has sort of changed its algorithms to reward different type of content, it seems like among a lot of influencers, like videos are getting longer. A few years ago, it was definitely like more about like sort of short, maybe 5-minute videos, 2-minute videos. And now they're like 10, 12 minutes and then even longer. Like we saw Shane Dawson do his whole documentary series, a lot of other videos, people like, especially top influencers are doing these like longer videos, even 45 minutes that the people seem to be engaging with. So it's cool to see how the platform has allowed for different content formats. And all of those come with different sort of like monetization opportunities too. So
maybe comment on Shane Dawson, for those who aren't familiar.
Yeah, so for those who aren't familiar, Shane Dawson is a YouTuber. He's kind of an old school vlogger. He's been on YouTube for a very long time. And he's kind of reinvented himself in the recent year as like a YouTube like documentary producer, kind of like a commentator. And so he does basically documentary investigations on other YouTubers. So it's this trend of like, there's a bunch of YouTubers that cover YouTube. They kind of pretend to be like journalists a little bit, but they're so like in the community. So they get access and they just kind of like do these deep dives about like what happened. So Shane Dawson just did like a 7-part series on Jake Paul, like exposing Jake Paul and supposed to be like the true story behind Jake Paul. So he does a lot of that type of stuff, which fans watch. They really do like to kind of see in-depth stuff about their favorite creators. So it seems like before that one, he did one on Jeffree Star, who was like another social media influencer in the beauty space, also kind of peaked early on and then kind of disappeared and now has this makeup empire. And so it's kind of interesting to watch. And it's interesting to see a lot of these like original old school YouTubers like reinvent themselves through like commentating on YouTube. Like Phil DeFranco, I would say, is another good example too, where he was like sort of has been on YouTube for a really long time, like probably 8 or 9 years. And now basically just runs like a YouTube news show and kind of just talks about what's going on in the community. So it's kind of like sports broadcasters where maybe they're done playing and they like start going to commentating and they all have a lot of really good access. So I think that's why people look to them.
I think it's just a natural extension of the fact that every aspect of popular culture is going to get commentary written about it.
Yeah.
Whether it be, you know, movies, whether it be, you know, movie stars and like who wore what at the Oscar red carpet, this is sort of the equivalent.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people like hearing it from other YouTubers as opposed to like, I don't know, some random magazine that doesn't really know what they're talking about, kind of like coming in and saying it. So, and they're presenting all of that commentary in video form on YouTube, which is where these people already are. So,
and so if influencers and creators can't count on the platforms to help them make money, on the one hand, they're cutting sponsorship deals directly. Mm. There was a New York Times article just recently about nano influencers.
Yes.
Who were posting for free product.
Yes.
So it extends pretty deep, you know, down levels of influence. But then for the people who have more influence, what are some of the other ways that they're finding that they can make money?
Yeah, so it is really amazing. I'll say I wrote about nano influencers over the summer in relation to teens. Mm-hmm. A lot of like the most prolific sort of like nano influencers. And just to clarify for people who don't know, it's basically like they're not even influencers. It's kind of regular people with usually less than 1,000 followers who are doing, you know, posting about brands or posting about products, just to get free products. And this, for marketers, they find it really effective because it's sort of like your friend who you know is actually not an influencer, like is using this. So you really sort of trust their recommendation. It's a big thing with teenagers who will do a lot for free product and don't really need the money. And so they'll, you know, post about that stuff. But as you obviously get bigger, then you can do bigger brand deals and obviously get different types of payment. So I think as you level up, like say you get, you know, suddenly you have 200,000 followers, you can do different types of brand deals. Maybe you're posting more sponsored content. Maybe when you have 1 million followers, finally, like the brand is actually paying you to promote custom content and maybe produce also video for their commercial or something like that, or like appear in a traditional ad. So
like Casey Neistat would be a good example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he's huge now and produces a lot of branded content and is also like uses his filmmaking skills for Samsung or whatever, you know? So I think once you reach that top echelon, it's an open door. You can pretty much work with brands in tons of different ways, but it's just about like getting up there.
But then beyond the advertising stuff?
Beyond advertising, they get money directly from fans. So some of them have a Patreon page, or they just have their PayPal or Cash App, you know, in their bio and ask fans. Like a lot of big memers sort of just take direct payments. They're like, if you like my memes and you're reposting them, like pay me $5 a month or, you know, follow me on Patreon or subscribe to my stuff.
So how does Patreon work?
Patreon is a platform that allows creators to like basically charge subscriptions for stuff. So you can sort of go on and support your favorite creator by paying them an ongoing fee of maybe $5 a month. And if they have 10,000 people doing that, that can sort of allow them to produce their art. And a lot of times people will produce custom content for their Patreon members. So maybe if you're a Patreon member, you get also a newsletter update about, you know, what your creator's up to every month, or t-shirt. Merch is also a big one. So people sell products to their fans that, you know, they think will resonate or whatever, that somehow connect to their brand. And then obviously fans buy them and they get a cut of that. A lot of them have their own t-shirt lines, or, you know, they make their own water bottle. Maybe if there's a fitness influencer. I just wrote a story recently on presets, which are sort of custom Lightroom filters that influencers use, which they sell to their fans. So maybe they use this one filter on all of their photos to get that kind of aesthetic, and fans want that aesthetic. So they sell them their custom filter for $30 or whatever. There's just kind of like endless amount of those opportunities. I think if you are an influencer, you need to balance out all of these, like just the same way you don't want to rely on one platform. You don't want to rely on one revenue stream either. It's really important to have like sort of more passive revenue streams. Like maybe you have a merch shop that people can buy, some Patreon subscribers, and then also like be doing these bigger brand deals that are going to have maybe a higher payout, but don't come as frequently. Well, a lot of other people also pay for promotion. So they'll pay for like maybe collabs, like say a younger influencer wants to grow his network or whatever, he might pay somebody with a bigger following to post about him or repost a video or retweet something. Doing promotional deals with other influencers is also a way to get money.
So Patreon is interesting because it's almost a somewhere between a tip jar and a paywall.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good way to describe it. I mean, it's a paywall in the sense that some people put all of their content behind Patreon. So some people say you have a hit podcast, maybe it's only for Patreon subscribers. And then other people are creators who are out there kind of like making stuff every day. And, you know, their Patreon members just get like perks or get, you know, extra stuff. Or it's just, you know, a lot, like it's like you said, it's sort of a tip jar where people just kind of pay to support their favorite person.
And in a lot of cases, they'll be asking for a particular purpose, like to fund mm-hmm. a new camera purchase.
Yeah.
To be able to continue to...
There seems to be growing awareness among, I think, fans about how much it costs to create content. I think, like, even in a few years ago, people just assume, like, oh, you know, these people are just out vlogging. It doesn't take that much work. And now, yeah, you'll see creators directly say, like, hey, I really want to get this new camera. Like, hey, guys, if you want to see me, like, do this better thing for my makeup tutorial, like, help, you know, get me this specific light or whatever. And we'll crowdfund that through, like, direct donations from their fans.
I think that there's historically been a relationship between fans and celebrities where you kind of look up to the celebrity, you sort of hold them as some sort of model of perfection that, you know, you aspire to. But it seems like a different relationship between fans and creators or fans and influencers than that historical celebrity type relationship.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about it is, like, even though a lot of the relationship is still aspirational, because you still, like, love this person and you almost want to be them in certain ways, or you're going to buy what they buy, right? Like, you also feel some sort of, like, not like ownership, but like protectiveness of them. I think, like, a lot of, like, you know, supporting someone is like expressing your identity through, I guess, supporting someone. So you feel like you're rooting for them and you want to support them and you want to see them do well, because it's, like, so tied up in, like, sort of who you are, in the sense, like, you feel very close to them. A traditional movie star, like, you'd never be, like, rooting for them, like, trying to get them some extra thing. But with influencers, it's like, yeah, it's a closer relationship and you kind of feel part of their success. Part of their success is directly based on their fandom. Unlike a movie star that, like, you know, they could get in a hit movie and they're kind of going to be lauded as successful and they're going to have a level of success. Like, you as a fan don't feel like you're playing as much direct role in it, even though obviously you are going to listen to their music and whatever. But, like, if you're, like, a fan of an internet influencer, you feel this, like, direct role in their success, I guess. I don't know. So even popular musicians are like that. I think, like, musicians that appeal to, like, a really Gen Z audience, like Ariana Grande, or people with huge online fandoms, like, have that, like, sort of, like, influencer type relationship with their fans, where, like, their fans feel this, like, huge investment in their success and, like, will stage these huge social media campaigns on their behalf, you know, just to, like, get their you know, song to number one, because they feel like they're, like, I don't know, you know, if it's, like, somebody from your hometown goes on to be really successful and you're, like, rooting for them because you're like, yeah, like, that's like someone that you feel close to. So it's good to see them kind of come up.
It is almost like a, well, I guess friend is the wrong term. But,
yeah.
But there is a closer relationship, maybe because you feel like you know them so well.
Yeah.
They share so much more than historically celebrities have done.
Yeah.
That creates that protectiveness, that one, your desire to, like, help them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to imagine, for instance, anyone buying a t-shirt with Angelina Jolie's catchphrase,
yeah.
Right?
Or like, wanting to help her. Yeah, like, no one would, or like Nicole Kidman, or like they're just not people that you want to, like, help. Whereas, like, people like Ariana Grande fans will, like, paper, you know, her face up at their school, like, just to, like, help her, like, you know, or create, like, a stan account for her. Like, it's because you're, like, rooting for this
person.
When you
say stan account.
A stan account is basically, like, a fan account. It's like an appreciation account, I guess you could say, for someone. So
On Instagram
or Twitter, I guess, too. It's like being a super fan of someone. And so you're going to create this whole... It's basically like, yeah, you'll support them through anything. And usually that means through some kind of aggressive social media campaign, which, yeah, you just wouldn't see for, like, older celebrities or celebrities that don't, like, have that sort of, like, that don't resonate in that way with their fans, like, in that influencery way.
And I guess one of the things that you pointed out, which is super interesting, is that musicians have had more of this sort of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people will buy the tour merch and they will buy, you know, that's one of the few things where people will buy merch.
Yeah.
But not in a way, you can't imagine, you know, someone wearing a Brad Pitt t-shirt or a or an Ocean's 11 t-shirt.
Yeah.
They'll absolutely be wearing a band t-shirt.
Yeah. I think that music is probably, like, the closest correlation. Music resonates so deeply. Traditionally, you haven't had as much access to the artist. So maybe, like, yeah, you have your favorite band and you stand, like, or you're a a huge fan of that band or the people in that band, but you don't feel this, like, closeness, I guess, with that particular person, maybe, or you don't have as much access to them in the past. Now, like you said, with Instagram, you kind of, like, see their face every morning on your story. I think it's harder with actresses, although I would say, like, actresses, like, I don't know, Ranny Ramirez or some, you know, did some of the Disney Channel people, like, people do have that kind of, like, music type fandom around them. I think just because of like the nature of their audience and stuff. I guess musicians have had it for longer, but I think it's different and more pronounced now, especially with artists that come up on social media, because it feels like you made them. Like, it feels like you're responsible for them, you know, and their success.
I wonder if that's because with musicians, their music gives you a window into who they are, what they think, what's important to them, in the same way that you get with social media creators and influencers, but it's very different. Like, you, the person that you see on TV or in a movie almost definitionally is not the celebrity. It's a role that they're playing. And so you don't have that same closeness and therefore that same affinity and willingness to sort of want to help them and protect them.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely is like a barrier. I think that's why, like, especially like young actors, maybe even if they are like on the more traditional route, the ones that are really successful or have this like rabid online fandom are people who are also leveraging social media to like generate intimacy and like generate their own like online fandoms. Well, there's like Emma, what's her name? I can't remember. She is like a YouTube, does YouTube acting, like, you know, but she's also very out there on Instagram. I think like a lot of young people in Hollywood, like, if they do use social media to connect directly with their fans, like, see benefits of that as opposed to, like, kind of, I don't know, staying away. Noah Centineo Centineo, I always say his name wrong, who just started a bunch of Netflix movies, I would say, is a good example of this. Like, first of all, Netflix, like, he has this huge now online fandom from these, like, teen heartthrob Netflix shows he was in. But he also, like, keeps up with them. Like, he follows his, you know, he follows fan accounts about him. He interacts with fans. He posts, you know, every day out there on Instagram, like, being kind of weird. Like, and that stuff, I think, has just really, like, put him on the map, I guess, because it's helped generate this like online buzz that he could never get from being, if he had just been in those two Netflix specials and then like wasn't really out there on Instagram, like, I think people would have forgotten about him by now.
I wonder if with Disney actors and actresses, the fact that you see them grow up also gives you that sense that you actually know who they are. Especially someone that, you know, emerges as an adult.
Right.
Into fame and celebrity.
Yeah. You feel like maybe some nostalgia because you're like, yeah, like this person, you know, they were young when I was young, like 4 years ago or whatever. It's been interesting to watch a lot of like teenagers now are very into like early 2000s culture. Like a lot of them, like a lot of young girls are so into like Britney Spears and like think Paris Hilton is really funny. There's so many like early 2000s kind of like nostalgia accounts on Instagram. And it's weird because I'm like, you guys were like 5 years old. Like, I don't know. But I think it's like, I think it's also this like standing of like, oh, mom, like she's funny. Or like you vaguely remember this person from when you were really young. And so you kind of like that they're out there, I guess. I don't know. It's been weird because I'm like, I remember when Britney was was still cool. But she's it's like weird to see her like get all of these really young fans all of a sudden.
HQ Trivia recently had a Friends special quiz edition. And it was one of the best performing ones in recent times. And it's the same idea of that nostalgia for the early 2000s.
Yeah, it's been crazy. I think like just enough time has passed where like people are kind of like missing that. And also I think you have millennials who are starting to feel kind of old. And so like they also are like nostalgic for that time because that's when they were like teenagers, basically, myself included. So I think, yeah, like maybe, yeah, I don't know. It's just a cool moment right now, I guess.
And I guess the dream of a lot of folks who grew up on social media, became famous on social media, is to cross over into traditional media. But there haven't been a lot of success cases so
they're
far.
Like almost never successful at that. I think, well, I think it's weird. I think it's changing now, like I said, where I think a lot of it's like enmeshing. So like Noah Centineo is a perfect example of that. Like somebody who's like half social media star, half kind of like streaming icon. I think for a lot of people that come up on social media, they want that like mainstream validation. I used to work at People Magazine and like they just like would freak out, you know, if they're in this like mainstream thing. And unfortunately, a lot of them are not successful. Like Logan Paul is a really bad actor and was trying to go that route too and kind of failed. And they don't have a lot of the skills to do well in traditional entertainment. But I think more people, especially people that are coming up, are realizing it doesn't matter because they have more online clout than a lot of these other actors. And they'll eventually get roles because of that. So it kind of doesn't really matter if they're like great, but they'll never like win an Oscar, I think, most people, because they're not traditionally trained. But yeah, I think that's going to go away. I think like people are going to realize that it doesn't, that kind of mainstream relevance doesn't matter. And what they have online is just as powerful.
Do you think that Logan Paul is a better boxer than he is an actor?
Yeah, Logan Paul. Yeah, Logan Paul's really, really, I'm sorry, he's a bad actor. Yeah, he's probably better at anything than acting.
But how much did he make in that pay-per-view boxing?
So much, some insane amount, like $40 million or something crazy. He made a lot. That was a great stunt for them to make money on. I mean,
maybe talk a little bit about
it. Yeah, so Logan Paul staged this big boxing match with KSI, who he has this sort of like online feud with. KSI is a British YouTuber. And then his brother Jake Paul boxed Deji, who is KSI's younger brother, and Jake Paul is Logan Paul's younger brother. So they staged this massive stunt in London, you know, in this boxing ring where they charged people to watch this live stream of the big fight, and they all kind of like hyped it up on social media for months. And they ended up, yeah, they sold custom merch, they sold tickets to the event, and then they sold sort of like pay-per-view, and they ended up making a lot of money. I can't even remember the exact number, but it was a lot of money.
Tens of millions of dollars.
That kind of stunt and like real life event, especially when there's the designated winner or loser, is really powerful. Like, obviously you want to see your fan win. Also, like, this was promoted with like months of fake beef and like rap battles and stuff. So it doesn't surprise me that it did well.
Well, social media thrives on
drama. Everything is drama. That's why Drama Alert, this channel on YouTube that covers YouTube drama, is like huge. But I don't know, like, we'll see. And also, I think a lot of people were annoyed. I think the fight at the end was like a draw or something. So everyone was mad and said it was staged, but they'll probably still pay for the next one too. But
and we're going to wrap up shortly, but before we go, I want to talk a little bit about some of this idea of crossover, in particular with Brat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Chicken Girls.
Oh my God, I love Chicken Girls. It's this like show. Okay, Brat is this, I don't know how to describe it, but basically they have a YouTube channel and they make a bunch of like custom shows for Gen Z audience, I guess. And they hired a bunch of kids that are mostly like YouTube, or, well, there's YouTubers, Musical.ly stars, and sort of influencer kids, I guess you could say, who act in it. And they're actually not bad actors for like a kids show. A lot of kids love it. I sort of like heard about it from a lot of kids. I think because they follow these kids, like they follow a lot of the people that are in the show, you know, on social media. So they watch it, and
it's built in audience for this show, right?
Oh my gosh. It's basically a built in audience. I mean, that's why so many, especially like casting directors, think about online audiences when they cast, because, you know, it's the same way about, like, I wrote about like sports teams and, college basketball and how like the internet's changed that. And it's the same way as like, if you have two high school basketball players that are basically like the same skill, but one is coming with 1.2 million followers, and you know that, like, you know, that's going to get a guaranteed audience on your, you know, basketball program, that's great. That's the same thing with casting a show or a movie. So Brat's done it really well, where they sort of have made these short form little shows for YouTube about like high school life, using these like influencers that have a huge amount of following. So their followers love it and watch it and stan all the kids.
The implication of this is that the idea that there's a separate online world and offline world is really breaking down. It's just the world.
Yeah, that's sort of like informed most of my life and writing, and I think it's like still people are realizing it. Like, still people think of it different. Like, still people think of everything as so different and separate. But every year, everything becomes more interconnected. So if you can recognize that, like, especially in the entertainment world, it's just a helpful thing, I guess, to know.
Well, thanks, Taylor. This was super fun.
Thanks for having me.
I love talking to you, and I love reading your work. You have your finger on the pulse of what's happening with this intersection of popular culture and technology. And I think that very few people really understand this well. And I think you've spent the time and gone deep and have the relationships. And so it's always illuminative.
Oh, thank you. Well, I really appreciate it.
This podcast is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. For more details on this episode, head over to tbtpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.